can't honestly say that I was ever discriminated against in any way because of being a nurse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the Army treated male nurses and female nurses the same or any differently? I mean, were you given different assignments?
I think that a good example is when I had put in for my doctorate in they sent Joe Maloney, okay, so he was a man, but then when I put in, they sent Sarah. I definitely think that was because she was, quote, one of the girls.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of female nurses, I think probably, I don't know how much more, if any more than that, were certainly homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a group, you know, that if you knew, you know, you got promoted quicker or you got things like this and like that. And I think she was that way. And I'm just not saying that because of bitterness. I've heard other people say it too, so. But other than that, one thing, and I guess it wasn't a big thing, I don't feel I was discriminated against by the nurse corps at all. In fact, many of the women in the nurse corps, in fact, women are responsible for where I got to.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they were sitting on the promotion boards, they were sitting on the school selection boards until some of us got up to be colonels and lieutenant colonels when we started doing that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly can't complain, you know. I got my anesthesia training for 2 years, my undergraduate and my graduate degree in the Army, all expenses paid, so.
Right.
All that discrimination.
Right. And you said that the one nurse that was sent to the doctor program, he said that she was a homosexual, and that maybe there were some female nurses who were homosexuals. Was that a common perception of the female nurses, or do you think it was somewhere a reflection of a reality, or?
No, I think it was a reflection of reality. I mean, you could talk to people, other women, and they would say, oh, yeah, she, you know, she sleeps with so-and-so, or she has to act and all this kind of stuff, just like, you know, some of the guys would stick together a bit. And, you know, and I think, well, maybe it was I that was it just bitter, was it sour grapes that I didn't get sent? And particularly after a year or so that this lady, I mentioned her name, so please don't say anything.
No. I'm just curious about general perception.
She died. And she was a very nice person, don't get me wrong. I liked her very much. We were friends.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I had more experience than that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, you know, why? She wasn't exceptionally a star or anything like that. She's like the rest of the psychics came up through the ranks.
And you said, too, that you had joined the Army voluntarily and that you had feelings of national service and that sort of thing. Had people in your family been in the military? Did you grow up around that?
Oh, yes. My great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was a Denison, and he was over here, I don't know, 16 or the Denisons were here in the 16, early 1700s, but I had a great-great-whatever-grandfather who was in the Revolutionary War, so, you know, my daughters can become daughters of American Revolution. I can become a son of American Revolution, and I never did that. So we had that, and we had some, throughout the years, we had the military. There were some in the Civil War. I don't remember. I have all my stuff downstairs. I had my Uncle Jimmy was an Air Force pilot, a fighter pilot in the First World War. My Uncle Denny, who's still alive, was a bombardier in the Second World War. In fact, he was the bombardier that led the Schweinfurt Raid, if you know what the Schweinfurt Raid was. There's ball bearing plants in that, and he's still alive, too. And then me, and of course my stepfather.
Mm-hmm. What
it has been not every generation, but the majority of generations since the Revolutionary War have been in the service of one kind or another.
Uh-huh. And what had your stepfather done in the military?
He was in the Air Force.
Oh, okay, in the Air Force. And did he talk about it a lot, or I mean, did you kind of hear stories growing up, or?
Oh yeah, you know, he had gotten out, and he waited. He met my mother. He waited till he got out, and told me some of it. He worked on the Norden bomb site, which was the bomb site that they put in the bombers in the Second World War, which is way to Tinian Isle, which he got to. And Tinian's also in the same Saipan was. In fact, on his way to Tinian, the two atomic bombs were dropped to end the war with Japan. So when he got over there, the war was over, and he spent a few months there, and he came back and was discharged.
Uh-huh. And so when you signed up for the Army, what do you think were your big motivational factors?
The draft was still on, and I figured, well, they're going to get me, you know, one way or the other. I mean, the Korean War was over, and they're going to get me anyhow, so why don't I might as well just go in, and, you know, maybe I can request to be stationed near home or something like that, which is kind of what happened. I was in Philadelphia, but I got stationed, you know, in June, so.
And you signed up directly into the Army Nurse Corps?
Right.
Okay. And how, just when you signed up, you were a second lieutenant first, and so how did that, or how did you relate more to the doctors that you worked with, other nurses, enlisted men? Who did you, I guess, hang out with or socialize with?
I don't know. Yeah, you were, in those days, you were an officer, and enlisted men were a little different than that, but I used to work night duty. So I became friends with the sergeant and that, but, you know, we really didn't hang out with each other. And there was a nurse there, a major, who really was my mentor. She was really, really good. She showed me the ropes, you know, of med-surg nursing in the Army and the whole thing, you know, what you do. Oh, she broke me in other words, how to do stuff. And with her encouragement, I actually went into anesthesia school. I started working nights because I was dating my wife in Philadelphia. And so I'd work 10 days on, I'd have 4 days off. So either every time I had 4 days off, or at least every other time I had 4 days off, I was driving up to Philadelphia, or she was coming down. And so my time was working until the morning and going to the mess hall and having breakfast with a bunch of the guys, enlisted guys, and then going back to the hooch and going to sleep for about 8 or 9 hours. And in the evening going over to the officers club and just, you know, bumping around over there with some friends.
And was that the same in Vietnam as well?
Yeah, in Vietnam, they had an officers club over there, but it was also officer NCO. And so you had a mixture of the officers with the non-commissioned officers. So. And in Vietnam, too, because of the situation being a combat situation, it was you were just a little more close and more friendly with everybody, whether they were enlisted or the CO of the hospital or whatever. You know, it was a camaraderie, a unit, you know, cohesiveness, if you want to say, you know, we were there to do a job and let's do it. And then, of course, then the, you know, the cocaine and heroin crap started.
Was that a big problem? You mentioned the one OR tech who OD'd. Was drug use a problem among the medical staff as well?
He was the only one that OD'd that I know of. I think there were some others who were shooting up, but they never got caught. Most of the ones that we were working on were the combat, the combat soldiers shot at.
Morale among the medical staff in Vietnam?
Oh, I think we all wanted to get it over and get home. But we all stuck with each other, and you learned to, as you went over there, and I went in, Fred Brockschmidt, he and I are still friends, he was the nurse over there, and Teresa, I don't know, she was the other nurse in Essex, and I came in, and, you know, he got broken, and, you know, they left, and somebody else came, and as people came, you know, you break the new ones in and say goodbye to the old ones, but it was always a unit, we had a good CO, and we were there to support the 82nd Airborne, and of course, not only that, and they're supporting troops in that, too, because they had to go.
Mm-hmm.
And he stood in front of it, and the thing went off. You don't stand in front of the rocket launcher when you're loading it.
Right.
It went right through him.
Mm-hmm.
It made a nice hole, and it took his liver and everything. Of course, by the time he got over to us, he was dead.
And you said you signed up and volunteered to go to Vietnam, and then they sent you to get your master's and then sent you to Vietnam, right?
Right.
And was it just kind of expected that you did a war tour if there was a war on once you were, you know, a career officer? Sort of expected?
You know, John, my friend, talking about going to nursing school together, he was in Korea. And Vietnam, I know some guys that were in Korea twice in Vietnam. I know some guys, nurses, that were in Vietnam twice.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky I didn't get to go to Korea. I just went to Vietnam once. I went to Italy. John spent 5 years in Germany, and Jim, my friends that we travel with, they spent 3 years in Germany. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you think you would have been sent even if you hadn't volunteered?
Sorry?
Do you think you would have been sent anyway if you hadn't volunteered?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Just, they wanted me to go get my master's degree first.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And were there any kind of, you know, discipline problems or issues that you had to deal with? You know, once you were in Vietnam, you said you outranked most people that you worked with. Did you sort of get stuck with dealing with those issues? Or?
Microwave screens.
Uh-huh.
And we all had beds. I had a bed, and I had a piece of plywood on the top of it. So anytime anything got pretty hot, I'd just, you know, get under there for a little protection. It was the same thing in Play Coup. We'd get under the bed. But anyhow, I went home for Christmas time, and I didn't tell Pat I was going to get there. And we got out early, and we flew from Cuba. We flew down by helicopter to Saigon, then Air Vietnam from Saigon to Hong Kong, then Hong Kong to Tokyo, then Tokyo to Los Angeles, then Los Angeles to Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been up for something like 60 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, I woke my wife up, and she was surprised. So I said, well, why don't you go to bed, you know, and I'll lay down with you for a few minutes to go to sleep, because I was just exhausted. So I lay down, I fell asleep. Well, down there at Christmas time, they shoot firecrackers.
Uh-huh.
So the firecrackers are off, and I'm under the bed, and Pat comes in, she says, what are you doing under the bed?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I thought I was in Vietnam. I said, that is second nature. When you hear this stuff, you get under the bed. That's the only thing I've had. I've never had any flashbacks. I've had a couple dreams, but they were about people, and that really wasn't about the war itself.
Right.
So I was very fortunate there.
Uh-huh.
We had a nice little club there, so we'd go over and drink. So I'd get to drink. I didn't get drunk in that, but we'd go over every night and drink. And we had a cook who was a real good warrant officer, and he also ran the kitchen over at the officer's club. And so we go over there a lot of times for dinner and that. And of course, we knew a lot of the Vietnamese people that worked for us, particularly the women who were our hooch maids, you know, would do cleaning up and all that kind of stuff. I never had them fear or anything like that, but they were nice people. And we had learned that after we left Phu Bai, that I guess a year, I don't know what it was anyhow, whenever Saigon, when we left Saigon, and the Vietnamese took over, and that we understand that they went to a lot of these places, including that hospital, and we were told that many of the people, that particularly the women that did a lot of the menial labor, and that were, you know, shot because they were collaborating with the Americans. And that, now, I don't know particularly if a certain one was, but we heard that.
And you'd mentioned that you went home for Christmas. Was that unusual? I've never heard anybody else say that, that they got to go back to the States.
We had leave. We still had 30 days of leave or something every year, even though we were over there.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't care where you went. Most of the people went to Australia for R&R.
Mm-hmm.
Or they went to Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
Or New Zealand, and I decided for R&R, I want to go back and see my wife.
Right.
If I could get back, I'd get back, and, you know, I did. As I said, you know, I hopped around, Major and I, and he was the executive officer, and we hopped around and went back, so I ended up with about, I guess I had a whole 6 days at home,
mm-hmm.
rather than 2 weeks in Australia.
That's interesting. Just a couple more things then, and I'll let you go. You've been talking for a long time now. The memorial that went in D.C., what did you think about that?
I thought it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Not necessarily the wall, but the statue of the women, and yeah, sometimes it's called the Women's Memorial, sometimes it's called the Nurses' Memorial.
There's a memorial there for the women who were there attending to some GIs.
All right.
Which I thought was very, very nice.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the women I knew in the Army actually was one of the ones responsible for getting that memorial done.
Mm-hmm.
Collecting money and, you know, getting people to vote, et cetera, et cetera. She spent several years doing that.
All right. And which one was that?
That was the women.
Uh-huh.
Women there for the women nurses. I'm not sure which, but it shows some nurses there.
Right.
Yeah, taking care of some GIs.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, which of the women that were in charge of that did you know?
Oh, I don't remember her name.
Uh-huh.
She was a nurse.
Uh-huh.
Army nurse, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And a colonel, she retired.
Okay.
We were stationed together, I think, when I was in Madigan the second time, or at Brooklyn the second time, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
She was very active in that.
Mm-hmm. And so you thought that the memorial was a nice memorial. Was there any talk among any of the male nurses that all of these people in the statue were women?
Gosh, I don't think so. I didn't think anything particularly about it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I thought it was probably overdue.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And do you read much that's been written by any of the nurses?
I haven't seen anything there, actually. Now, the Vietnam Wall, to get back to that,
uh-huh.
Very nice.
Uh-huh.
That one made me cry.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the nurses that I served with in Italy, Brian was her last name, she was a very interesting individual. She was a major, and she was one of the, I think there were 10, nurses on the Bataan death march.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
She would never talk about it very much. Hattie Bryant. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, was there anything that we didn't talk about that you thought we might discuss or that you wanted to mention? Or?
Oh, I don't know. Keep in contact with four or five of us. They're all, and that's just John died a couple years ago. Oh, actually, he's been dead 4 years, 5 years this year. Can you believe it? I think that when we went into anesthesia school, John and I in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
and other anesthetists too, we were using ether.
Mm-hmm.
And open drop ether, inhalation ether, and cyclopropane. And when I was in anesthesia school in 1960 in at Letterman Army Medical Hospital, a new anesthetic agent came out named halothane. And there was no vaporizer for it at the time. So what we would do is we would put it in an ether vaporizer, which was a little glass jar with a wick in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a thing at the top where you adjusted, you know, like real scientific. You open a little bit more, you get some more, whatever. The whole thing, you know,
uh-huh.
Money's sufficient to do what you want to do. You don't have to have a PhD to do that. And, well, in those days, of course, the anesthesia machines were ventilated right into the rooms. So therefore, the people that were in the room, the surgeons, the scrub nurses, the scrub technicians, the anesthesia personnel, et cetera, were breathing this stuff. And I remember I used to go home and my wife would say, oh, Barry, you used ether today, or you had biothane, or cyclopropane, or this new thing called halothane, huh? Boy, you've been using that a lot lately. Well, eventually over the years, of course, they found out with not ventilating the anesthetic gases, there was definitely increase in spontaneous abortions of pregnant female people in the operating room.
Mm-hmm.
And so many years ago, they started, of course, ventilating all this stuff. So now when you ventilate a patient, you pop off, you know, there's a certain pressure. You don't want to give the patient anymore. There's a pop-off valve, and that's sucked out through a thing. And excuse me a minute. Ventilated to the outside air.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had one friend, Marty Hensley, he was a, and he became the chief at the Health Services Command, which is also in San Antonio, right next to the academy. And he ended up having a big cyst on his liver. Well, John, I ended up having renal cell cancer. And I had a radical nephrectomy in 1988 or 89. And what's very serendipitous how it was found, my younger daughter was getting married. And my wife and I were moving some furniture. And I ended up having a varicocele. I don't know if you know what a varicocele is. But your testicle gets enlarged, engorged with blood, venous blood.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it's on the left side, but I had mine on the right side, and I figured, yeah, I was just removing something. I probably, you know, maybe broke a blood vessel or something. But I thought, I'll go see the urologist. I went to see the urologist, and he says, oh, yeah, it's probably from moving the furniture. He says, well, you know what I think we ought to do? I think we ought to get an ultrasound on it, because it's usually on the left side, not the right side, because the anatomy, we do understand, not being a nurse or a doctor, but the anatomy of the drainage. Up at back up to the abdomen. So I went and I found out I had this little thing on my kidney. And then they did a CAT scan, and sure enough, so I had this radical nephrectomy due to renal cell CA. And I was very lucky. Mine was contained within the kidney itself. It never had metastasized. You know what metastasized is?
That's when
cancer spreads out.
Okay.
And you're metastasized, like to your lungs or to your brain.
Okay.
There's a primary tumor, and then there's a secondary tumor and metastases. The primary tumor I had was a kidney tumor.
Mm-hmm.
But if it metastasized more, it would have gone up to my lungs or my brain, etc. Anyhow, a year later, John,
mm-hmm.
my best friend, you know, nurse in school, best man in the wedding in anesthesia school 6 months after him, he was undergoing a physical exam. He retired many years before, and he was down in Lubbock, Texas. And he went over to Reese Air Force Base, and they were doing an exam on him, and he didn't feel good or something, and they palpated him, and they found this big mass. Well, they did him, and they found out that he had a big renal cell CA, but his was much bigger. And they operated on him, but his had metastasized. His was in his lymph nodes.
Mm-hmm.
So it eventually, of course, it went up to his brain and all that. And he died a couple years later. And Marie, his wife, and I were talking about this and this other thing that happened to our friend Marty Hensley with his liver cyst. And we said, you know what? We're wondering if this is a result of two guys, one who smoked, me at the time, and John who did not smoke. One who drank, I did, John didn't. But what did we have in common? We went to nursing school in Philadelphia. We drank Philadelphia water. We breathed Philadelphia air. But we did go to anesthesia school, and this new halothane was coming out, and we were breathing this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, since then, halothane has been implicated in causing many other things in a human's body, but not specifically renal cell CA. So Marie and I thought, you know what we ought to do? We ought to do a follow-up on this and see, not only in the Army, but survey somehow all the nurse anesthetists and all the anesthesiologists we can get hold of in this whole country, and see if any of them have ended up with renal cell CA, particularly in our age group that were learning anesthesia when we were ventilating all this stuff and we were breathing it.
Right.
And I said, Marie will let me know on that, but Marie never did anything about it.
Uh-huh.
And this week she's on her way to Guatemala.
I wonder if somebody will find out that it was.
Because I had a friend, my friend Jim, he was in Vietnam, and he was in Saigon, but he's put in for a claim now. He just went through a radical prostatectomy. You know what that is? Prostate?
Mm-hmm.
Prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm.
He had a radical prostatectomy. Well, it turns out that Agent Orange has been implicated in people over there, GIs over there, having prostatic cancer.
Uh-huh.
And he's putting in some papers now to get reimbursed or something or other that. And he said, you know, you ought to look into that and see if there's anything I mean to do, if there's something on record there.
Uh-huh.
That being in Vietnam, because John was in Vietnam too, if there was something in Vietnam, Agent Orange or something, that might have contributed to what we have. But I was never exposed to Agent Orange that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't sprayed on me, and I wasn't out in the jungles,
right,
you know, getting it. The only way I could have gotten it is if somebody came in with it on and I was breathing it in. It's the same thing with Jim. He's in Saigon, you know, down here, and, you know, they don't even know what was going on down there, so I wouldn't know where he got it.
Mm-hmm.
He would have less chance of I getting it because I was up in the jungle part. He was in a huge metropolitan area, and I was in the jungle, you know, we're 5 or 10 miles away. They were dropping it, Agent Orange, and maybe it, you know, I don't know. But anyway, it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, me. I don't know. about you.
No, it is interesting in the way that the benefits all work out, and you know how to get benefits for all of these different things. Interesting. Well, good luck with that.
I have my military retired pain. I retired from the University of Michigan. I have my retired University of Michigan pain, so I can't complain. It's been a good life. Now, what would I do over if I had my life to do over? Because I really enjoyed being an anesthetist, and nursing was okay.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this is again, but you know, you're taking care of people and what yak yak, all this kind of stuff. It's anesthesia. It's just really demanding, and it's just ultra demanding.
Mm-hmm.
That you can't bond with a person, I don't think, any more than that.
Right.
Taking their life in your hand and that. But of course the surgeon does too, and that kind of stuff. But you know, we always say in anesthesia, when the surgeon makes a mistake, we're the ones that have to correct it. I mean, we give the vasopressor, we have to give the blood, we have to do this anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
Here at the University of Michigan, we have a very good department of radiology, and within radiology is a specialty called interventional radiology. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Okay, well, there's several parts of radiology. There's taking your chest x-ray, and now, of course, there's taking CAT scans, and taking PET scans, and taking MRIs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And doing different things. Like, I went down 2 years ago and talked to Cho, the chairman of the department, did an arteriogram on my kidney. My kidney was left because when I had my radical nephrectomy, they found out that I had a kink in my left renal artery, and this is stenosis there, and so I only have 50% blood flow. So I have hypertension, so they were just checking it out to make sure that it hadn't closed down further, that I would need to have some surgery to that, and stuff like that. Well, interventional radiology, what they do is they do stuff like that, and they do other things, like they put stents in, and they dilate things. Now, cardiac, they do in the cardiac lab. Then a cardiologist does that, but there's a radiologist with them. When they put a stent in to your heart, into your arteries, same thing. That's interventional. It's an interventional treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's using radiology because you're using an x-ray machine and fluoroscopy to do it.
Uh-huh.
And when I went down there, I had a friend who was there. He had done his residency under Dr. Cho, and then he said to me, this is about, maybe 20 years ago. He says, you know, Barry, he says, this interventional radiology is just going to go places. And he said, we are going to start taking over more and more of what surgeons do. Instead of you cutting you open, we're going to take little balloons and dilate things, and we're going to go ahead and we're going to stick little stents in and kind of stuff like that. And I find that very fascinating. So, whoever again, I might do that, but I don't know. I like the anesthesia too much.
Sounds like you picked the right field then. After all of that. Well, I really appreciate it. There's a lot of interesting things that you talked about.
You know, I think that when I graduated from high school, I think now about what's happening to one of my grandsons, that even then, maybe I wasn't mature enough and I didn't know exactly what I wanted, you know, psychiatrist, yak, what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed the kids today, my grandson, 17 years old, he doesn't know what to do, so he's signing up to go to the Marines for a couple years.
Mm-hmm.
I have another friend, she's a nurse, and she has a master's degree. Her husband has a PhD. He has his own lab business, you know, where he does blood work and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And their oldest kid was doing so good, and all of a sudden he started on the dope, which my grandson had done. And all this kind of stuff, he looks like he's facing, he's going to have to go to jail because he last year and that kind of stuff. And she said to me, she has so many friends that this stuff is going on, and I think that the same thing happened to me when I went to school and I didn't know what I wanted to do really.
Mm-hmm.
But in that day there were less options. You just did something or you shaped up or something like that. I think the kids nowadays are graduating from school, and I don't know if it's the change in society, the family, the school, religion, or whatever, something's lacking. I think they're graduating more nowadays and they don't know what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Shame.
Wow, who knows? Glad I'm not deciding again.
Philosophy.
let me end the interview, and then I'll explain all about the forms I'm going to send you and all of that.